From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Terry Tempest Williams' family life has been intertwined with the landscape of the Great Salt Lake Desert. The desert was refuge, but it was also downwind from atomic bomb tests. Williams thinks it's no coincidence that seven women in her family have died of cancer. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Terry Tempest Williams about her memoir, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. Also, Only the Truth is Funny. We talk with Rick Reynolds about why he stopped doing stand-up and started doing monologues about his own life. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Hero, the new comedy starring Gina Davis, Dustin Hoffman, and Andy Garcia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Ross Perot announced today in Dallas that he's formally entering the race for the presidency with his running mate, retired Navy Admiral James Stockdale. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Ross Perot said that since the Democrats and Republicans refused to run on the issues, he would have to jump into the ring himself. Standing with his wife, Margot, and his children behind him, he said he could no longer stand by and watch the principles on which the country was founded violated. He also apologized to his supporters around the country for dropping out of the race on July 16th.
My decision in July hurt you. I apologize. I thought I was doing the right thing. I made a mistake. I take full responsibility for it.
Perot would not reveal what his campaign will look like in the remaining 4 weeks until Election Day, but he said that it would be highly unconventional. He also said he would refuse to answer questions about his character, which had dogged the first phase of his campaign in early summer. In Dallas, I'm John Burnett.
The Bush administration announced two new boons for politically important farm states today, another round of farm export subsidies, and the removal of some restrictions on ethanol fuel. President Bush held a news conference this afternoon to announce that he was setting aside a provision of the Clean Air Act to allow the use of ethanol in gas sold in some of the nation's smoggiest cities. Ethanol use is opposed by many environmentalists, but supported by farmers who grow corn, from which ethanol is made. Earlier today, Agriculture Secretary Edward Madigan said that the United States would provide $3.6 billion in credit guarantees to help foreign countries buy U.S. farm products. Democrats denounced the move as an election year ploy. Relief flights to Sarajevo are about to resume. Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger says there's some risk involved, but all sides are assuring the planes will not be attacked. Eagleburger says with tens of thousands facing a perilous winter, the U.S. cannot stand idly by. Barry Schwide reports.
Assurances in the bloody civil conflict in Yugoslavia aren't always reliable, and there are militia who operate under no government's control. But estimates of the perils of starvation and exposure prompted the U.S. and its allies to get started again after a month's suspension. After an Italian relief plane was shot down, France proposed a no-fly zone over Bosnia to keep Serbian planes away from the relief planes. The Bush administration is divided, with the Pentagon most reluctant to take even that limited a military step. Outweighing the risks, though, are humanitarian considerations. Land convoys to Sarajevo will be supplemented by air deliveries with the hope that forecasts of tens of thousands of winter deaths in Bosnia will turn out to be wrong. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost more than 17 points to close at 3,254. This is NPR. A bipartisan panel of current and former government health care officials said today that Governor Bill Clinton's plan to reform the nation's troubled health care system would provide insurance to more Americans and save more money than President Bush's plan. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
In releasing their findings, the five-member panel of health experts said their intent was not to endorse either candidate, but to simply provide voters with the facts they need to judge both candidates' health plans. Both plans would save the nation money compared to no health care reform at all, but Governor Clinton's plan would save nearly $600 billion more dollars than President Bush's over a seven-year period. And the president's plan would leave 26 million Americans uninsured in the year 2000, Governor Clinton's plan promises to ensure all Americans. President Bush calls for federal subsidies for the poor and tax deductions for the middle class to help them buy insurance. Governor Clinton would require all employers to provide benefits. The panel that evaluated the plans was organized by the advocacy group Families USA. I'm Patricia Neiman reporting.
House and Senate negotiators have reached agreement on a military spending bill for the new fiscal year. The $273 billion Pentagon budget would cut more than $1 billion from President Bush's request for development of the Star Wars anti-missile system. A new report on the Bank of Credit and Commerce International scandal says that BCCI officials got away with their crimes for years because of lax banking regulation in the United States and other countries. The Senate report blames U.S. agencies and the Bank of England, among others, for letting the bank keep operating after it was widely suspected of bribery, money laundering, and fraud. The report said that the Bank of England failed to protect BCCI's depositors and creditors. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The clan of the one-breasted women is how Terry Tempest Williams sometimes refers to her family. Her mother, her grandmothers, and six aunts have had mastectomies. Seven are dead. Williams has had two biopsies for breast cancer and a small tumor between her ribs diagnosed as a borderline malignancy. Her mother died of ovarian cancer years after her bout with breast cancer. Terry Tempest Williams is the author of the memoir Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. It's a memoir of the year her mother died. It's a book about family, the natural world, faith, and politics. Williams lives in Utah, near the Great Salt Lake. She's a fifth-generation Mormon. She says most statistics tell us breast cancer is genetic. What they don't say is that living in Utah may be the greatest hazard of all. That leads us to a recurring dream Williams used to have about a flash of light.
I did have this recurring dream of this flash of light in the night in the desert, and I had it over and over and over. And one night my father and I were having dinner, and I said, you know, it's the strangest thing, I keep having this recurring dream. And I explained it to him, and he looked at me very matter-of-factly and said, you did see it. And I said, saw what? And he said, the bomb. The cloud. I remember the day we were coming home from California, September 7th, 1957, you were sitting on your mother's lap, she was pregnant, and it was a few hours before dawn, we saw this explosion, I thought the oil tanker in front of us had blown up, we pulled over, and suddenly rising out of the desert was this golden-stemmed cloud, the mushroom. And he said there was this eerie pink glow, and within seconds, suddenly there was this light ash raining on the car. I was stunned. And he looked at me and he said, I thought you knew that. It was a common occurrence in the 50s. And I think it was at that moment I realized the deceit I had been living with, that all of us of this generation had been living with, growing up in the American Southwest, drinking contaminated milk from contaminated cows. And as I say, even the breasts of our mothers, members years later of the clan of one-breasted women. I had no idea, Terry.
Do you know which blast this was that you had witnessed unknowingly?
It was. I do. And I actually researched it to find out if that date was accurate. And it was. It was Operation Plumb Bob, one of the most extensive tests to ever be enlisted during that time in the 1950s through 1962.
I guess it's amazing to me that your family would have been driving along through the desert, see a nuclear bomb explosion, and not talk about it all the time afterwards.
Isn't that, I mean, to me that just shows that was the myth and the time we were living through. And when you talk to people who live in St. George, it was entertainment. I mean, they would climb to a particular ridge, and a few hours before dawn, they would watch the nuclear bomb as though it were fireworks, sitting on top of high schools, lovers that would go park. I mean, the stories are endless of the days when you could really watch that phenomenon with no knowledge of what it was really doing to them.
Did memories come back to you after your father told you what happened?
It was as though I had been punched in the stomach, and it took my breath away, and then I remembered. And what was so interesting is that from that moment on, I have never had that dream since. It was almost like that dream was just calling this to consciousness. And once he told me that story, it was out, and my life was dramatically altered.
So what did you remember?
I think what I remembered was the terror. And I must have imprinted on just the magnitude of that light. And the only thing I can tell you, even that young, was that it was so unearthly that it absolutely it went right into my bones on a cellular level.
7 women in your family have died of breast cancer.
Yes.
You've had 2 biopsies yourself.
Yes.
Do you think it's connected to the nuclear bomb tests?
I can't prove that it is, but I can't prove that it isn't. And when you look at the statistics in Utah of those individuals who have died of cancer after 1960, I have no doubt in my mind. And I look at those of my generation, you look at the obituaries in Utah, and it is daily. I think we were used by our government, and when the Atomic Energy Commission said it is virtually uninhabited desert terrain, my family, my generation, were some of the virtual uninhabitants.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Terry Tempest Williams, and her new book is called Refuge in a Natural History of Family and Place. When your mother was dying, she thought of death in a very spiritual sense and of course, didn't think of her illness politically at all. On the eve of her surgery, she asked your grandmother, who had also been through breast surgery, what to expect. What did your grandmother tell her?
I remember I was 15 years old at the time, and my grandmother was staying with us that night. I have 3 younger brothers, the youngest being 4. The telephone rang. I picked it up at the same time my grandmother did, and my mother said, "What can I expect?" My grandmother had also had a mastectomy, and she said, "Diane, it's one of the most spiritual experiences you will ever encounter."
And when your mother came out of surgery, that proved to be true for her. What did she tell you?
We met her in the lobby of the hospital, and I remember her radiance. And she said, "Children, I want you to know I have felt the arms of God around me." And we believed her. My father cried, and we believed her. And at that time, she was 38 years old.
How old are you now?
I'm 37.
So what did it mean to you when she said that? Was that comforting?
You have to understand, you know, we were, at that time, I was a very devout Mormon. That was how we had been raised. My grandmother had had cancer. My aunt had had cancer. It was a fact of life. So it was both horrifying to me because suddenly the thought of not having a mother was terrifying. It was as though this plastic dome of safety had shattered. And yet as I looked into her eyes and I saw her peace and calm, I think my impression, Terry, was there is something here I don't understand. And it was more about listening.
In your book, you write that in Mormon culture, authority is respected, obedience is revered, and independent thinking is not. Through your mother's death and through your knowledge soon after that of your exposure to nuclear bomb tests, you had this kind of like dual sense of death and illness. One is a kind of spiritual understanding that it can be a kind of transcendent experience to go through with an open mind and an open heart and everything, the kind of suffering of death. But at the same time, you're starting to think that there were political reasons why your mother was going through the suffering, and it had to do with the exposure to radiation. What kind of challenge did that present to your sense of faith, which, as you say, wasn't about questioning authority? And that's exactly what you started to do after your mother died, was question the authority of the government who decided to have these bomb blasts not too far from where people were living.
It gave me a focus, because I think there's a lot of anger that comes when you watch someone suffer, whether you acknowledge it or not. And when I realized that it may have, in fact, been because of our government's lying and the above-ground testing, suddenly I wanted to know everything about that. And so it really directed my energy in a very concrete way. And I made a decision to go down to the test site to see for myself what was there, and ultimately to make the decision to commit civil disobedience, which I did. I must say, there were foreshadowings along the way. I remember a year prior to Mother's death, mother and my grandmother and I were in St. George, and we were there when the Great Peace March came through. And we actually joined them for maybe a half a mile. And it was the first time I had ever heard my mother or grandmother sing outside of church. And I remember that morning we were going to go out birdwatching in a place called Beaver Dam Wash, but we had heard over the radio that night that there was going to be another nuclear test, and we made the decision not to go because of the venting that occurs. So it was almost like subconsciously we knew we were part of this story, and yet consciously we'd never spoke of it. And yet here we were marching a year before, and a year later I was arrested. And after being released in Nevada, I met my grandmother in St. George, and I will never forget her opening the door and putting her arms around me and just sobbing, saying, "Thank you, what you've done for all of us." And then my uncle, who was a vet from World War II, walking out of the room.
In anger?
Yes.
What was he angry about?
Our family is a very staunch Republican Mormon family, and for him it was an outrage. It was the ultimate act of betrayal.
Have you been able to keep your Mormon faith and challenge authority at the same time?
I think I take my cue from Octavio Paz when he says that revolution requires both love and criticism. So there are many aspects of the Mormon culture that I love, that notion of family, community, and there are other aspects that I find extremely problematic with the patriarchy. So it's a difficult question, and it's a complicated answer. And all I can tell you is that for now I've chosen to remain inside the church with a voice, but I think at some personal cost.
Have you been criticized by people in the church?
Yes.
But not excommunicated?
Not excommunicated.
You're a fifth-generation Mormon. Is it very important to you to keep in that tradition? Because it not only means keeping the faith, it means keeping a family tradition.
It's all about family. It really is, and my family's all in Utah, and my ancestors' bones are buried there. And I think as long as you can keep a sense of humor, and as I say, keep pushing the boundaries, that's my life. That's where I come from, and it certainly is not perfect, but it really is what gives me sustenance and strength, and particularly in the American West. I mean, the Mormon people came to Utah for religious sovereignty. And I think they have an enormous sense of place and community. And I think there's a great deal to learn from Mormon culture and history. But I also think there's a great deal to contend with and to question and to provoke.
My guest is Terry Tempest Williams, author of the memoir Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams. In your book Refuge, your story kind of alternates between your mother dying of cancer and you as a naturalist in residence at a bird refuge, talking about how the Great Salt Lake had risen and had flooded, and that was affecting the whole kind of natural scape of the area. What connections did you see between those two events in your life?
In the spring of 1983, Great Salt Lake rose to record heights, and the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge in northern Utah was flooded. That was the landscape of my childhood. Every year, every season, my grandmother and I would go and watch the long-legged birds. Avocets, stilts, ibises, curlews, herons, exotic birds. At that same time, in the spring of 1983, Mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And I'm not sure I did see the connection. All I knew is that I was splitting my time between keeping vigil at the hospital with Mother and going out the lake to see the birds. And at some point, I remember walking out to the refuge thinking, this will never be the same. This will never be the same. And as the water lapped up around my ankles, I could not separate the boundaries between the bird refuge that was drowning and my family that was in this landscape of grief. And devastation knows no boundaries. And it was all the same to me.
What happened to the bird population?
It declined radically. I mean, basically, the refuge was devastated. And the birds, many of them were displaced. Many went up to Malheur in Oregon and different places. But we lost an enormous amount of... We lost all of our wetlands, and we really did lose a huge population of the birds. But I'm happy to report, you know, 10 years later, the birds are making a comeback. The marshes are slowly returning. And to me, it is that power of regeneration that gives us hope and allows us to find refuge in change.
I'm going to ask you to read a section of your book that's a very moving passage that's really a journal entry, I believe. And this is about the day that your mother died and spending those last moments of her life with her. That'd be okay to read?
Yes. I'm going to be reading from my journal entry, Friday, January 16th, 1987. Walking into her room, I could see death was imminent, and I was surprised to see the physical changes from the night before. Her color had changed, especially around the mouth and nose. Her face was waxen. Her feet were cold. It was as though dying moves from your toes upward. Mother's breathing was regular, but strained, as she exhaled. So much going out, so little coming in. I knelt at the foot of her bed with the soles of her feet pressed against my forehead. It was the only place I could feel her pulse. I rubbed her legs under the mohair blanket. They were like ice. Dad paced the room, occasionally sitting next to her to hold her hand. We took turns. From 1 until 4 in the afternoon, we sat near her, a meditation. Her breaths could now be heard as moans. Her eyes were haunting, open, and clear. Time was suspended like watching a fire. Gradually, Mother's breaths became a mantra, and the death mask we feared was removed. My father spoke of what it had meant to him to take care of our own. In these hours, we began to realize the magnitude of these past weeks, months, years. Talk of everyday life crept in, basketball scores, the day's news, even laughter. And there, Mother lay, dying. I never doubted her presence. The light in the room deepened. It occurred to me that Mother would wait until after sunset, and it was an exquisite one. An apricot aura radiated above the purple ochre range. I told Mother what a beautiful sunset it was. I recalled her applause on another afternoon. We turned a small lamp on. Mother's color looked better, and for a moment we believed she would never die. The belabored breathing continued. We took turns holding her hands, rubbing her forehead, moistening her mouth, and we could feel the cold moving up her body. Her head was turned now, and with each breath her head drew back, reminding me of the swallow I beheld at Bear River, moments before it died. Dad began to get nervous. He worried that Mother could go on for a few more days, that we had kept vigil too many times. He smiled with an anxious grin, saying, "Diane, you may outlast me yet." Our eyes met, death eyes. I looked into them, eyes wide with knowledge, unblinking, objective eyes. Eyes detached from the soul, eyes turned inward. I moved from the chaise across the room and sat cross-legged on the bed next to her. I took her right hand in mine and whispered, "Okay, Mother, let's do it." I began breathing with her. It began simply as a mirroring of her breath, taking the exertion of her exhale, ah, and reflecting back a more peaceful expression. Ah, Mother and I became one. One breathing organism. Everything we had ever shared in our lives manifested itself in this moment, in each breath, here and now. I was stunned by the way her eyes fixed on mine, the duet we were engaged in. At other times, I just closed my eyes and merged with her, whispering once again, "Let go, mother, let go." But mostly, it was just breath, slowing down, quieting down, until only the sweetest, faintest expressions of breath remained. Eric Fromm writes, "The whole life of the individual is nothing but the process of giving birth to himself. Indeed, we should fully be born when we die." A full moon hung in a starlit sky. It was Mother's face illumined.
That's a really beautiful passage, and I thank you for reading it. I know when you wrote this book, one of the things you did was show it to the members of your family and ask them to help you edit it. I think that's a very kind of gracious, generous thing to do when you're writing about people and about their lives. What kind of knowledge about each other came out of that? Do you know what I mean? About showing them your book in which you wrote about your mother and her death and your thoughts about other people in the family.
I think it provoked a great deal of discussion. I think we are not accustomed to death. We don't have that opportunity to be with death. And I think because our family had two chances, the first chance in 1971 when Mother had breast cancer, we shied away from it. We did not do well. The second time, I think it was a very conscious decision as a family that we wanted to face this with Mother head on. And we did the best we could, having no idea what territory we were entering. And I think we were all very raw after that experience. I felt that it was only fair if I was telling this story that my family be part of it and that they have veto power of those things that they were not comfortable with. And there's a very fine line between what is personal and what is private. And I think the most powerful aspects of this story in Refuge were the ones I did not tell. What did it reveal of my family's character? I remember giving my father the first draft as I was heading on a plane for New York to give it to my editor as well. When I got to the hotel, the red light was flashing. I called my father. He was outraged, saying he couldn't believe what I had told, that he looked like a hothead. You know, he was furious about the fact that I had mentioned he had cried. What would his men think who worked for him? And then he said, "And then your brother would like to talk to you." And my brother got on the phone, and I said, and he said, "I can't believe what a minor character I am." You know, so I think we all had our issues to deal with. But I think in the end, my family realized this was my story, and the story that they would have to tell would be very different. But I think as a family, we emerged with a sense of wholeness, a sense that each day is a gift, and that we must live our lives with unguarded hearts, and that also a revolutionary character is essential to our own survival, that blind obedience in the name of patriotism or religion ultimately takes our lives. And I think our family, having gone through this experience of watching the women around us die slow, heroic deaths, has made us much more fierce and much more compassionate, with that notion that grief does dare us to love once more, and it is a love that is wild.
Could you ever imagine yourself moving away from Utah?
Terry, I can't. I really love Utah. It's my home. I am deeply committed to it. I think it's about residency. And it's about really digging in. I mean, sometimes I think the most radical act we can commit is to stay home, because then we can be mindful of the changes that are occurring. And we have a voice, and we know the myths, and we know the language, and we know the stories.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Terry Tempest Williams' memoir is called Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If the people in your family weren't related to you, would you ever see them again? This is a typical Rick Reynolds question. He says his family has rewritten his Kafkaesque childhood and changed it into a Frank Capra film. Now Reynolds has transformed it into a comedy. His family is the subject of his book and his comic monologue, Only the Truth is Funny. Coming up, he'll tell us why the truth is funnier than the material he used to do at comedy clubs. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Hero, the new comedy starring Dustin Hoffman, Gina Davis, and Andy Garcia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Ross Perot announced this afternoon that he's back in the presidential race, and he apologized to supporters for dropping his plans to run less than 3 months ago. The Texas billionaire has already spent $16 million of his own money on his race for the White House and is expected to spend millions more. Perot announced that retired Admiral James Stockdale, a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War, will be his running mate. Perot said he's running because neither political party has addressed the issues concerning the American people, and he said that he will answer no question that does not deal with the issues of this campaign. The White House says Perot's decision to enter the presidential race won't change President Bush's campaigning, and on the campaign trail in Wisconsin, Democratic challenger Bill Clinton says his campaign plans won't change either. Clinton says the focus of his campaign has always been to challenge President Bush. NPR's Ira Glass reports from Milwaukee.
Clinton said today that he won't change the way he's campaigning because Perot has entered the race.
I think we're going to win this campaign because I've got the best program with the broadest support from Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and a lot of former Perot supporters. It's the best program for the country's future.
Clinton said that Perot's economic plan puts deficit reduction ahead of creating jobs, increases taxes on the middle class, and might actually slow the economy. Clinton also called a new Bush campaign ad so bogus it's unbelievable, with its charge that Clinton would raise taxes on the middle class. Clinton said the charge is a disgrace and a shameless attempt to get votes under false pretenses from a president who admitted that he would say anything to get elected. I'm Ira Glass in Wisconsin.
After 10 years of negotiating, the Senate has ratified the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START. The vote was 93-6, far exceeding the two-thirds majority needed. NPR's Ann Gerrels reports.
This is the first treaty to actually reduce the arsenals of long-range nuclear weapons. The START treaty cuts the fast-flying intercontinental missiles, the most dangerous nuclear weapons, by roughly one-third. Republican Senator Malcolm Wallop of Wyoming, one of the few dissenting voices, called the treaty a ruse, a dream, and a prayer to the tooth fairy. The administration argued the treaty locks in verifiable cuts and provides a structure for future reductions which have already been agreed to. Russia and the United States now have about 22,000 warheads altogether. Over the next 9 years, they will go down to about 15,000. And under a follow-on to START reached last June, the two sides are expected to cut back to about 7,000 warheads, or roughly 3,500 each. START II is still in draft form and has yet to be sent to the Senate for approval. I'm Ann Gerrels in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 17 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, fighting continued in various parts of the nation, including the capital. In northern Bosnia, the International Red Cross has put together a convoy of buses and ambulances to carry more than 1,500 prisoners led out of a Serbian detention camp to Croatia. In Geneva, UN officials say that mediators hope to end the fighting in Sarajevo by arranging ways for the various fighting factions to pull their forces out of certain areas. On Capitol Hill, the House has turned down many of the Bush administration's key education reform proposals and has approved its own educational plan. Another presidential veto is likely. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The democratically controlled House authorized $800 million to reduce class size, raise academic standards in math and science, and waive all regulations on federal education programs in 750 schools across the country on a trial basis. The money for schools, though, would be tied to reform efforts and some evidence that students are making progress. The House voted to promote public school choice, but it threw out President Bush's proposal for vouchers that would have gone directly to families to pay tuition at any school of their choice, private, parochial, or public. U.S. Education Secretary Lamar Alexander says he'll recommend that President Bush veto the House education bill. In a news release, Alexander said the bill epitomizes what's wrong with American education, suggesting that House Democrats and special interest groups are blocking real change in schools. The bill now goes to the Senate. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The government has announced that 18 nations will get credit guarantees to buy U.S. farm products worth more than $3.5 billion. These guarantees will cover purchases of U.S. farm products during the fiscal year starting today. During the past fiscal year, more than $5 billion in U.S. farm products were sold with credit guarantees. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last summer, I was staying at a hotel in San Francisco. At a small theater next door, there was a performance by Rick Reynolds called Only the Truth is Funny. I didn't go because I have two rules. Most comics aren't funny, and most one-man shows are bad. So it turns out I would have enjoyed myself. How do I know? I just heard a recording of it and read the new book version. There will be yet another version of Only the Truth is Funny in January when it's on Showtime. Rick Reynolds used to be a stand-up comic, but his jokes weren't as funny as the real story of his life and his family. Well, actually, his life isn't particularly funny. Some of it's pretty tragic, but it's funny the way he tells it. Here's an excerpt from the opening of Only the Truth is Funny.
Hi, my name is Rick Reynolds. I was born in Portland, Oregon on December 13, 1951. As I write these words, I'm 40 years old. I stand 6 feet, 2.5 inches tall. I weigh 195 pounds. I have big hands, a big nose. I believe my penis to be of average size. I'm losing my hair. Now take a look at that cheesy picture of me on the cover of the book. I wouldn't even have this pathetic wisp of hair on my head if I hadn't paid thousands of dollars years ago for hair transplants. I guess you could say I'm vain. I know that I care way too much what other people think about me. I'm insecure and often jealous of my peers. In fact, I sometimes hope for horrible things to happen to my friends. Pardon me for noticing, but there are some good things about me as well. For example, I am the most honest person I've ever known. That might sound like bragging, but believe me, it's true. Besides, what's worse, thinking you're the most honest person or saying you're the most honest person? For some reason in our society, we're not supposed to notice our good qualities. And if we do notice, we certainly should not mention them. I'm also the most open person I know. I have no secrets, none. And I'm not saying that I have no lurid fantasies, embarrassing faults, or painful memories. Of course I do. But you know what? They become so much less lurid, embarrassing, and painful the more I talk about them. That's why I wrote this book.
And that's Rick Reynolds reading from his new book, Only the Truth is Funny, which started off as a monologue that he's performed in different parts of the country. Well, Rick, you actually started out as a stand-up comic. What you did as a stand-up comic, that wasn't the truth?
No, it wasn't the truth. And it wasn't the truth in a couple of ways. One, it wasn't the truth literally, you know, a funny thing happened on the way to the club, those sorts of lies. But it's also not the truth in a very bizarre way that there's a dynamic between a comedian and his audience. Whereas an actor gets up on stage every night and pretends to be somebody he isn't, a comedian gets up on stage every night and pretends to be himself, which is a really odd phenomena. And I felt creepier as a comedian when I did tell the truth, because I'd say it with the same inflection every night, and then it got to be that it was somebody else's truth I was telling. It's a really bizarre concept. So when I started to actually say, what I want to do is talk about the things I love talking with my friends about late at night, the existence of God and all those trite sophomoric things we stopped talking about in college, I set about writing a show and performing a show. And I am absolutely amazed that I did it for 2 years without lying. And I really think that I did. Every night I got up and felt the emotions. And it's much the same as, especially if you fall in love anew, you know, and the person that you've fallen in love with hasn't seen Citizen Kane or whatever it is that you love, and you get to see that, you get to see it with them fresh. It's like telling the same story you've told 100 times to a new friend.
Did the kinds of laughs that you got change when you started doing your monologue? I mean, did it sound different when people laughed?
Yeah. Well, at first it started at the improvisation in San Francisco. For 9 months I did it there. And in the beginning, people were really pissed. They asked for their money back, and they'd yell out, as do, you know, obnoxious hecklers, "You're not funny," and things like that. But then I got these really great reviews, and then people with ties started to come, and they raised the prices and stopped serving drinks and stuff. And then it took on another dimension. What I really, at the end of any sort of performance, there is an applause, and I break them into one of two categories. Well, actually three. You can suck and not get very good applause, but if they really like you, sometimes they like you because you entertained, you were very funny, and sometimes they like you because they like you. They think they know you, and they like who you are, and that is by far the richest kind of applause, and that's what I started getting, and that's what I really loved.
Mm-hmm. Did your voice change when you started talking about your real self?
Oh, very much so. Well, there's something that all comedians do. Well, not all comedians, most comedians have a comic glitch, have a, you know, sort of a dialect all of their own. One of the things they do is they put emphasis on a preposition where it shouldn't be. You know, I'm going to the store. People don't talk that way. They say, I'm going to the store. And if you listen to enough comedians, I mean, somebody could do a study of this, but I used to do that. And I stopped doing it, and I started talking in the way I would talk to anybody, my wife at home. Another thing, there's an odd thing about laughter, I think. It's one of the few ways you can elicit an emotional response from somebody that's unintended or that they have no control over. That, I think, in crying. And I think it's one of the reasons that comedy clubs are popular. You go and you just burst out laughing. And that is an immediate gratification. You know, I tried to write novels and I couldn't do it. I see why novelists are drunks, you know, because it takes years to get that reinforcement. But a comedian gets it immediately. And when I started doing the show, there were 5 and 10 minute stretches where there were no laughs. In fact, there was this cathartic, dramatic stuff going on. And during that silence, beads of sweat would form on my forehead, and I would think, I've lost them. I'm being self-indulgent and syrupily sweet, and they hate me. And then at the end, I'd get that response, and they'd come up afterwards, some tears in their eyes, and they'd say, I led the same life you did, and thank you for this. And that was really the hardest thing about moving from stand-up to this format, was those moments of silence where you had no idea what they were thinking.
Mm-hmm. Rick Reynolds is my guest, and he has a new book called Only the Truth is Funny, and it's the same title as the monologue that he's been performing, which will soon be on cable TV. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Rick Reynolds is my guest, and his new book is Only the Truth is Funny, which is the same name of his monologue. You ask in your book, if you weren't related to your family, would you ever see them again?
Right.
Would you?
No. It's so sad. My mom, we fly my mom down a couple times a year to see us and, of course, Cooper. We just had a $45,000 kitchen remodel done. It could be in Home Beautiful. It's perfect. We're proud of it, you know. My mom walks in, she looks at it, and she looks around and goes, oh, look at this scratch over here. And she goes, oh, too bad that this happened. And we're reading the newspaper, and, oh, a woman was raped in Santa Rosa. And she, every time I call her, there's the murders, and she's so negative. It just drags it out of you, you know. And I love my mother, but I don't like her much as a person, you know. And it's weird. I mean, here are these people. I would never go, let's go have turkey with these people that I can hardly stand. You know, I'd never say that. But you feel an obligation, and I kind of enjoy it. You know, but they know all my buttons because they were there when they were put there, and they know how to push them. And it's, you know, I don't know. So many people I know feel that way. It's my challenge in life that every time I walk into a room, my son will love me and smile and want to be with me, you know. And I know so many people that were screwed up by their parents. And, you know, you just vow that that will never happen and you just work really hard on it.
So you're working on that now, huh?
I'm working on it now, yes.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks.
Now, your mother, you say, was manic depressive.
Uh-huh.
And she used to beat you. Before she was diagnosed and started taking medication right. for that.
I discover now that every, not that I'm a celebrity, but all celebrities were beaten. It's coming out in the last couple of months. So.
Yeah, that's right. You should be talking to Oprah about this.
I know. I'm in good company.
But anyways, your mother also had a knack for getting into relationships with men who would beat her. Until she married a guy who you were really crazy about, who was nice to you and mm-hmm. mowed the lawn, and then you found out he was a bank robber and compulsive gambler with a prison record. When you found that out, was there something actually thrilling about it?
No. Oh, no. It was the capper to my mom's life, it felt to me. It was nothing but awful. I mean, it was unbelievable, because you'd think, you know, he'd disappear for a while, and what was he doing? And I didn't know, and he was off on these gambling sprees, and I guess some mafiosa guy showed up at our door once and threatened my mom. I don't think I felt anything neat about it. In retrospect, it was, you know, it's something that happens to other people. You know, it's like winning the lottery or something. It's just that I look at this life, and as I was living it, I knew that my friends, their houses smelled better and they had more money and stuff, but I didn't know that my life was that bizarre until years later when I could compare notes with people.
Okay, so you say only the truth is funny, and I maintain that the truth may be very funny to the person telling the story, but for the other people who are the supporting characters in the story, the truth is usually not all that funny.
Right.
Because the truth that you're telling the way you see it, A, isn't necessarily the truth the way they see it, and B, it's not necessarily what they want everybody else to know about.
Right.
Since a lot of the stories here are about your mother and about the problems she had beating you and getting beaten by boyfriends, how happy can she possibly be with this turn in your career?
She loves it.
Really?
My mom and I have talked about this, you know, and she's like, oh, God, my friends are going to read this. I have teased her so much. I mean, we talk about these things, you know, like she'll get kind of upset with me. And I said, Mom, you want a coat hanger? Because she used to beat me with a coat hanger, you know. And she does laugh about it. And, you know, I said to her, Mom, these things happened. And you know, because they actually happened, that is my defense that I can say them. And there's nothing in the book that any member of the family would deny. I mean, just nothing. So, you know, what do you do?
Yeah, well, I bet all her friends can come up to her now and say, so I suppose it's true that you used to beat your son.
But, you know, I think that in a way she comes out heroic in the book. I mean, it seems to me, because she is nothing that life didn't force her to be. And her beating me is because she was chemically imbalanced. And once she corrected that, I mean, once she had shock treatments, which I talk about in the book, and now she's still on medication, she, you know, from that point on never beat anybody. So I don't really think you could say it's her fault.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in how you got from suicidal young man to stand-up comic. How old were you when you tried to kill yourself by leaving the gas burners on?
Probably 24, something like that. I've always wrestled with this thing. You know, it always seemed to me noble. Suicide still seems to me noble, which is probably a horrible thing to say on the radio. But it's always romantic to me. And you know, like with the doctor who was killing people, it seems fine to me. If you're at that point in your life, you own your life and you can do what you want with it, you know? And I was a miserable kid. And now, you know, the whole point of the book, I guess, is the trite idea that the little things in your life are all that exist and all that is important. But it got to the point that once I understood that the chocolate I love to eat and the movies I love to watch and the emotions I felt with my friends, that's much more important than the fact that God doesn't exist or that if I were to write a book in a million years, the world is going to implode and it won't have meant anything. You know, once I realized that, that's when I started getting happy, as I say.
Did you think you'd actually make it when you tried to kill yourself?
No. In fact, I think I even point this out. It was a half-hearted suicide attempt. I used to play this game in college, and I played it all the time, where I would turn off the pilot light on my stove, and it didn't, turn on all the gas. And then I'd lie down on my bed, and I wouldn't permit myself to get up until I could think of a reason to go on living. And sometimes it was something like, oh, this movie's playing that I haven't seen, or, you know, whatever it would be. And one night, I'm just sitting there thinking, and this and that, and I knew I'd get up and shut off the gas, and then I fell asleep, and I was asleep, and then somebody broke the door down, and they busted some windows, which is stupid because they weren't locked. And they roused me. And the first thing I felt was embarrassment because, you know, this looks bad. It's not a good thing to have done. And so it's more embarrassing. It wasn't the noble, you know, like I figured life out and I don't fit into it and I'm doing this thing and I didn't leave a note or any of that stuff. So it's an embarrassing chapter.
So in addition to being embarrassed, did you feel kind of renewed, you know, like, oh, this was silly. I didn't really mean to kill myself, but I might have. Guess I'm lucky to be alive.
I guess only momentarily. It's like you're falling asleep on the freeway at night and you go off into the gravel and go, hoo, hoo, and that wakes you up for, and that adrenaline shot goes in there. But then an hour later, you're drifting off again.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So listen, now that you're professionally funny, what still really depresses you?
Here's something that worries me a lot. My wife is pregnant, and we had a sonogram the other day, and we're having a boy. And it seems a secret how hard it is to raise a child. I mean, they kind of tell you, but they don't prepare you for the hell that it is. And of course, it is so humongously rewarding on the other end. It is the reason to exist. But, you know, just putting Cooper in his car seat and he's whining and he's fussy, thinking of having that and a baby, I just go, how do people do it? And our parents had 4, 5, 6. It's like this incredible thing. And actually, from a woman's point of view, especially if you breastfeed, it's unbelievable what you forsake for this, you know? And, you know, I never realized it before, but just what my wife's going to have to go through again about it it depresses me. Although in a couple of years when it's okay and, you know, the kids are playing together and you say kiss daddy and they do and, you know, you get all the positive things, it's all worthwhile. But we're just going to have this nightmare for a couple of years.
Well, when they're saluting you as Father of the Year, you'll be happy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Rick Reynolds, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you a lot for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Rick Reynolds' book, Only the Truth is Funny, is published by Hyperion. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, Terry, we'll have a report on Ross Perot's press conference today, and we'll follow that up with a conversation with the author of a book about third parties in America, and we'll talk with him about the role that third-party candidates and third parties have played in presidential politics over the years. We'll also have a report on the fact that an unusual alliance between the Minneapolis police and street gangs came to an abrupt end this past week, with an execution-style killing of a police officer. At least one of the four suspects in the case is linked with the leader of the gang organization that has been cooperating with the police. And we'll also have letters from listeners.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. On paper, the new movie Hero has everything. Big stars like Dustin Hoffman, Gina Davis, and Andy Garcia. A first-rate director, Stephen Frears, who made The Grifters and Dangerous Liaisons. And even a hot screenwriter, David Webb Peoples, whose last movie was the Clint Eastwood hit Unforgiven. Does it all come together? Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see.
Hero has a neat premise. It's the kind of elaborately rigged mousetrap that movie makers like Frank Capra and Preston Sturges used to spring on audiences in the 30s and 40s. And it goes like this. Bernie LaPlante, played by Dustin Hoffman, is a creep. In fact, he's such a creep that as he's being arraigned for the umpteenth time on stolen goods charges, he lifts his own lawyer's wallet. But one day, when he's driving through the rain on his way to pick up his son and take him to the movies, a plane crashes in front of him. And even though it's a terrible night and he's worried about messing up his shoes, Bernie finds himself shuffling into the wreck and saving people's lives. Then, without anyone knowing who was that masked man, he disappears. After all, he's still got to take his kid to the movies. Of course, when he finally shows up, hours late, his ex-wife, played by Joan Cusack, is so mad, she doesn't even want to let him in the door.
Why don't you let me in instead of waking up everybody in the whole neighborhood? All right, if you let me talk, for Christ's sake, I'll tell you what happened.
What happened is the same thing that always happens. You blew it. Only this time, you broke your son's heart instead of mine. He was so proud, looking forward to going to the movies with his father, and you let him down like you let everyone down, always. What did you do, take a mud bath?
That's what I'm trying.
I don't want to know. Some fantastic adventure, right? Something really crazy.
It's tough out there. It's a damn jungle.
Well, back to the jungle, Bernie.
What Bernie doesn't know is that one of the lives he saved belongs to intrepid TV reporter Gail Gailey, played by Gina Davis. She wants to find out just who the so-called Angel of Flight 104 was, and her station offers a reward if the hero will only identify himself. It turns out that, like Cinderella, Bernie left a shoe behind, and whoever matches it will win $1 million. Well, a penniless drifter named John Bubber, played by Andy Garcia, matches it easily, because he gave Bernie a ride, and Bernie left his other shoe in Bubber's car. The joke is that Bubber the fake is lauded and celebrated and actually turns out to be a terrific guy, the perfect hero. He helps the homeless, he inspires sick kids in hospitals, he makes America feel good, and he makes Gina Davis fall in love with him. Meanwhile, poor Bernie can't get anyone to believe that he's the rightful recipient of the money. And no wonder. Nobody can stand him. The irony is lovely, and director Stephen Frears works it out meticulously. And yet, once we get it, which is pretty quickly, there's not much left for the movie to do except flash it at us again and again. Hero feels strangely thin and familiar. It lampoons the media, American gullibility, and our hunger for imagery in ways that we've seen 1,000 times before. And besides, it isn't as outrageous as it pretends. This movie would have been more interesting, for instance, if it weren't so eager to let Bubber off the hook. What if he didn't feel such obvious remorse for his big lie? And what if Dustin Hoffman had decided to play Bernie not just as a pitiable creep, but as a truly repugnant one? Hoffman's performance isn't deeply felt enough to make us really root for Bernie, and it isn't tough enough to make us confront our distaste for him. In the end, there's only one performance that fits the breezy screwball mood the picture is struggling to attain. In a movie jam-packed with stars, Gina Davis turns out to be the real hero.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Kezia Perlman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with James Foley about directing the film adaptation of David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Glengarry Glen Ross. The film stars Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Ed Harris, and Alan Arkin. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.